WA Barge Boss, who is speaking to us on his friends the Demons, the Fallen Angels, and other Phantasma. So we're going to read to introduce tonight Mark chapter 9, verse 14 to 27. James.
Right. Thank you, Sam.
Okay, so if demons do not exist, let's try to pinpoint who Jesus was talking to with these dialogues with demons and who was talking back. So remember that we're dealing with the healing miracles, and we're dealing with the ones predominantly where demonic language is used, demonic with a small d. And hopefully by the time we conclude tonight, we will be able to summarise the whole point of why we have spent three entire nights looking at the underworld. So, to say one had a demon equates to one having an illness. It's like saying you have malaria. Now, if you have malaria, I don't think you have bad air. Well, I don't want to be too specific about the bad air, because that's what malaria means. Mala, bad air aria. Okay? Because of where they originate, where they thought the disease originated from. And they were pretty close. So our friend Lucifer last week. Now, just to clarify, it was Lucifer from the series Supernatural. That's why he didn't look like the Lucifer that we can only deal with by spearing his heart with an Enduro post. What Lucifer said... Did you record that, Poppy?
No.
Oh, come on. I can't give you free plugs if you're not going to be alert. This front row needs to really step up. You'll be on one leg before you know it. And what he said was, well, we talk about inner demons, and inner demons is just, it's just a metaphor. So it's about our worries. It's about our anxieties. So we use that terminology today. So we have to understand what the terminology was at that time and not make assumptions about it. Guilty. Okay. Now, the other thing which is curious is there is no demons in the Old Testament. There's a pandemic in Jesus' time. There is no demonic language used with any of the healings under Samaria. Now, it's significant because more than a third of Jesus' healing miracles occurred under Samaria. So there has to be a reason why. We've got to ask ourselves those questions. So we had a look at this story of the underworld where Saul goes and meets the Witch of Endor. I never concluded this story because it's part of tonight's story. So we want to deal predominantly with fallen angels tonight on our little subtopic. So remember, Saul is convinced that what the witch has said is true. She was scarily convinced that Saul was convinced. And it was true. She prophesied the time of his death and the time of his son's death. How did she do it? Was she one of those really good, like $10 psychic tarot card readers? No, I think it's quite clear what happened. She was the one talking. Saul had an evil spirit that came and went. The evil spirit was given to him by God. It was his guardian angel. It was the angel that was talking. Saul had rejected God and God had rejected him. So what we hope to look at tonight is we're going to look at 3 points on this accommodation language. I'm going to sort of whiz through the idea of symbology. There's quite a lot in it. Like I've got an enormous amount in it. So I'm going to try to summarise it in 10 words and then give us 3 quotes to look at. Why did Jesus talk to evil spirits? I'm giving the game away when I'm saying, well, he is talking to angels. We'll identify why and how I think that. Who and what is a fallen angel? We'll look at angels of evil. And if we get to the case study of Mark chapter 9, we'll look at the epileptic boy. And as I mentioned previously, we'll have a look at some of the symptoms of epilepsy. And when we see these miracles, we often try to label them, but I don't know whether we do a particularly good job. So we're making a lot of assumptions about this particular topic as a conclusion I've reached. All right, so I'm going to give 3 examples that we haven't dealt with before about the language of accommodation. Now, some of us might not have even came up with this idea before concerning the language of accommodation. But here are three examples. Okay, so from the medical books. We've spoken about the history of malaria. So in West Africa, even though they had a cure for malaria, quinine, it took them decades to break the spell of the West Africans, and the spell that they were under was demons cause malaria. Well, lo and behold, someone has popped a pill and then they were eating them like lollies because there was miraculous cures of malaria until there was a disease, a malarial disease, or a subset of the disease called cerebral malaria. And it made people behave nonsensically, erratically. And of course, the West Africans went back to their original mythology and folklore, which was, oh yes, well, the pill cures normal malaria, we get that, but we need to go and find the old witch doctors because this person's possessed. So the doctors tried and tried and tried. They couldn't get them to pop a pill until one clever doctor came up with an idea. He explained to this particular group that they had a pill not for malaria, but for dealing with demons. They ate the pills, they were cured. The doctor has accommodated their thinking, hasn't agreed with it. It was the same pill, didn't even change the colour. All right, second example of accommodation. So sadly, I have a bit of personal experience with this. So when psychiatrists are dealing with a multiple personality disorder, where literally a personality can change in a millisecond, it's good practice to ask, who am I talking with today? Is that a new idea? So let's think about last class. Who asked who, what's your name?
Jesus
asked Legion, what's your name? Who am I talking to today? The message says this, tell me your name. He replied, my name is Mob. I'm a rioting mob. Can anyone give me the names of any other healing miracle person where Jesus has asked their name? Now, we know the name of Jairus' daughter, okay? But Jesus didn't ask that. I mean, that's obviously a coincidence. No, it's accommodating. It's accommodating the position of the way the person genuinely feels at the time. No one is agreeing with it. His name wasn't Legion. Like, Jesus didn't correct him, and so his name's not Legion, but it's a starting point for the conversation. He was possibly called that, or he possibly thought that about himself. Okay, let's give you the final one. So I'm going to take us back now to Mount Horeb. We've got the battle. We've got God versus Baal. So we've got Elijah and the priests of Baal. What did I say? Horeb. Oh, wrong mount. Oh, we're getting there in a moment. Hang on. Mount Carmel. So all day, these poor priests of Baal are trying to get their God to respond. What does Elijah taunt them with? Oh, maybe Baal's gone on holiday. Maybe Baal's fallen asleep. Maybe, just go a bit harder, you'll wake him up. Yes, he was being sarcastic. But he doesn't say Baal doesn't exist. God's actions demonstrated that. But he was accommodating their position. So when we think about that type of language use in the Bible, which is prevalent, then we need to consider how it might impact on this topic. Ooh, so now we're going all a bit crazy, so I'm going to go back here and see what happens. I want you up, but you're not up. Why aren't you up? Now I want to talk about symbols. So remember I said there's a number of different considerations, like there's a number of ways we could interpret and have been interpreted the demon story. Now, I've got a lot of information on this. I'll keep it to 10 words as best I can, and then we're going to look at three quotes. Okay. You can take your shoes off because it might be more than 10 words. OT, now that's one if I say OT, right? OT, demons equal idols. Okay? NT, demons equal illness. Demons equal evil spirit. Evil spirit equals uncleanness. Okay, so just register that. Okay? Right, I've got about 5 pages of notes on that. So, there is an argument that the healing miracles using demonic language revolved around the neurological system. Okay? I want to see and demonstrate how these concepts align. But first, let's talk about what a symbol is. So we know that a symbol is something that is used in place of something else. So if I walk out tonight and there's no clouds, I look up, I see a moon. Tomorrow, hopefully, if there's no clouds, I'll see a sun. And 9 out of 10 times in the Bible, that's how it's used. But there are other times where the sun and the moon are used to represent leaders, secular leaders and religious leaders. I'm confident that the use of this term devils and unclean spirits is meant to have us thinking about something deeper than just the story that's going on. When we have a look at the story of Mark 1, which we read a couple of times, so hopefully we'll remember that, what was the most resonant message that the people got? Was it the healing? Or was it something else? Trev knows. 1, 2, 3, I think 4 times, the most powerful message was Jesus.
Power and authority.
And what he was saying. His teaching. His teaching. Yeah, exactly. His teaching. It wasn't what he was doing. So when I think about uncleanness, my mind automatically goes to the law, and I think about clean and unclean animals. I think about instruments that were unclean and people that were unclean for 1, 7, 30 days, 6 months, whatever the story was, and uncleanness meant separation. Come with me, please, to Ezra chapter 9. So we're going to have a look at 3 quotes here. So, demons were idols. Idols caused uncleanness. They caused separation from God. God said, worship me, and people were worshipping something else. So let's have a look at Ezra chapter 9. And verse 11. I think I've got King James here version. Which thou hast commanded by thy servants unto the prophets, saying, the land unto which ye go to possess it is an unclean land, with the filthiness of the people of the lands, with their abominations, which they have filled it from one end to the other, with their uncleanness. With their uncleanness. So these ideas are starting to combine. Is a land unclean? Yes, it can be polluted, but it's unclean because of what the people are doing to it. It's the people who are unclean. Why are they unclean? Well, it tells us. The filthiness of idols. Right. So park that. Come across now to Ezekiel chapter 36. And we'll look at verses 6 there. We'll have a look at 17 and 18. So interestingly, as you're looking up that section, what we read tonight in Mark chapter 9, there was frustration when Jesus says, oh, foolish generations. Now, I think that's an unusual thing for Jesus to say. Was he having a crack at the disciples, the lack of unbelief, the political system? Or was he making a general observation about the whole nation before he did the healing? Verse 17. Son of man, 36:17. When the house of Israel dwelt in their own land, they defiled it by their own way and by their doings. Their way was before me as the uncleanness of an unremoved woman. Wherefore I poured out my fury upon them for the blood that they had shed upon the land and for their idols wherewith they had polluted it. So once again, we've got this relationship between uncleanness, idols, which are called demons in the Septuagint. But what God says here is, that's happened, but I am going to make you clean. God's plan is to make everything clean and pure. Zechariah chapter 13, verse 2. And in that day there shall be a fountain opened in the house of David and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem for sin and for uncleanness. I just read verse 1. And it shall come to pass in that day, verse 2, says the Lord of hosts, that I will cut off the names of the idols out of the land, and they shall no more be remembered. I will cause the prophets and the unclean spirit to pass out of the land. So this is a prophecy about what God wants to happen. Jesus is the vehicle to make that happen. Verse 9. But it comes at a cost. And I will bring the third part through the fire, and I will refine them as silver is refined, and will try them as gold is tried. They shall call on my name, and I will hear them. I will say to my people, and they shall say, the Lord is my God. Israel, from about a decade after they got back into the land, we remember Jonathan, Moses' grandson, that set up that shrine. It lasted for 750 years, that one shrine. There is virtually no more idolatrous people than the Israelites. God is jealous. This is a battle of the mind. He wants Jesus to win it. So I think the story is a lot deeper than just a cure, which in itself is quite critical. And just remember, one final point about what that man in Mark 1 said of Jesus, what he called him, the Holy One of the Lord. He was. He was the Holy One of the Lord. So Jesus had the power to cure, but more importantly, he had the words to change people's lives, which could change a generation, which could change a nation. So when we read this language, what we need to interpret from it is there is something more that's going on here, and it's about me. But better still, it's about an amazing plan that God has. Let's talk about angels. So we remember last year that Matt Oliver did a pretty amazing series on the angels. He's invested a lot of time and effort into it. Hebrews chapter 1, verse 7, and of the angels he says, he maketh his angels spirits and his ministers flame of fire. Now, angels are God's spirit beings, and by spirit we mean that they don't have a physical body. Why did the police officer set the ghost free? Come on, Huey. Because he couldn't pin anything on him, right? Because he's a spirit body. Good help's hard to find. Now, also in Hebrews 1, angels are also called what?
Gabriel.
That's a name. Good. So I'm going to say verse 14. Close. Angels are... And in the Greek, it's weird because it means something like a public servant. It's a weird term. So it's the angels then who are listening to God's instructions, who are planning out how to deal with it. They're trying to work out what angel is best to deal with it, or series of angels, and then they have to wait. and then they deal with the instructions. They implement the plans. Okay, this is Lucifer. So I want to talk about the background now of this idea of fallen angels, and there's probably three or four possibilities, right? So the first idea is this. Sometime in the remote past, there was a bunch of angels in heaven that went rogue, they rebelled against God, and they were subsequently shown the door. So that's sort of rare, but it is one of the background to this idea of fallen angels. The more common one is from Genesis chapter 6 and verse 2, where it says, "The sons of God saw the daughters of men." Okay? So what is interpreted from that is that angels came down, fell in love with these beautiful women who they made wives, and so the offspring of the immortal angel and the earthly women are demons. Now, of course, Jesus clears this up for us in Mark chapter 12, verse 25, when he says, angels neither... Who said marry? Beautiful. Marry? That's right. All right, so it's clear that if angels don't marry or they're not given in marriage, then that interpretation of Genesis chapter 6 is incorrect. I'm not going to go into what it is, but that view is just is wrong. Well, what about Lucifer? Well, according to Rotten Tomatoes, the Tomatometer, it achieves a score of 88%, and it has a very good plot, where the summary is, suddenly Lucifer starts to wonder if there is hope for his own soul. And you think, oh, yeah, okay. Pretty interesting story. Right, what about the other Lucifers? Okay, in Australia, we call them redheads. Dick Smith made another product which is named something different, but originally, like Lucifer's, was called a match because you've got this little flame. But does anyone have an ESV with them? A nod. Catherine, can you please quietly look up Isaiah chapter 14 and verse 12? Now, whilst Catherine's looking that up, if you go to Wikipedia, and Wikipedia disses the idea of Lucifer being a devil, you sort of, no, you must be reasonably close. What do we read in Isaiah 14 verse 12? Okay, so that's the verse where we read Lucifer. Who heard the name Lucifer? That's good listening. Well, it's not there because the ESV has just translated what it actually is. It's just the title of a star. There's lots of conversation about what that star was a symbol of, and that was Cyrus. So God is in control of the world, and every day that there's billions and billions of activities, of missions that his angels are carrying out. Now, good things happen to us occasionally. Bad things happen to us also. He, therefore, God, is the originator of all good and all evil circumstances. Not the cause, all right? So we'll have a look at Isaiah 45 in a minute. But let's just think about angels for a brief moment. Who's been in contact with their angel today? What's your angel's name? What does your angel look like? Have you ever met your angel? Have you met your angel and perhaps missed it? A couple of weeks ago, Joe told us an amazing story where he believes it was an angel that intervened. I can tell you a few stories that have been shared with me too over the journey. So, our angels do save, protect. They also set up circumstances to test us, to put us under the refiner's fire. I will try you like silver and gold. Angels, brothers and sisters, can also take lives. Now, some of our trials are hard. Like, they're really hard. There's trauma. they're difficult for not only the individual that's having to deal with heavy stuff, but from the perspective of children or a spouse or friends, some of the things that happen to us are positively evil. And sometimes the Bible refers to the angels of evil that have to deliver those tough things.
James has got to fit in with God's character somewhere to create.
Yep, we'll have Isaiah 45, we'll have a look at that. Yep. My point here really is that I've called these demons in the New Testament spirits of evil, and I've called them that for a reason. Psalm 78. So he cast upon them the fierceness of his anger by sending evil angels. Now, I don't think the angels themselves are evil. I don't think they're fallen angels, but they're evil if they're doing God's ministrations and fulfilling his will, and they are responsible for what you and I would interpret as evil in the human experience. So therefore, I think that the spirits exist. And to Legion, they were evil. To the man possessed by the Capernaum ghost, they were evil. To Mary Magdalene, they were evil. To the man who had just one son with fits, evil. If you were blind, it was evil. To Saul, his experience is evil. It was given to him, not once, not twice, not thrice, but four times, by an evil spirit. And it wasn't just him. Judges chapter 9, there's an evil spirit. That weird story of the lying tongue about Ahab in, 1 Kings 22. An evil spirit. I was sent there to tell lies. And you go, what? Well, to Jesus, those he healed were afflicted people by the will of God and under the control of his spirits of evil. They were evil to me because I couldn't see. But my angel had a job to do. And that's why Jesus spoke to them. Jesus spoke to them and they responded. Jesus regularly spoke with angels. We might have a look at one example tonight if we get around to it. So let's have a look at this idea. Isaiah 45, verse 7. I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord, do all of these things. So what is the definition of evil? So adversity, affliction. If you've got that open in the ESV, it'll say calamity. The NIV says disaster or distress. God's not evil, 1 John 1, verse 5. God cannot even look approvingly on evil, Habakkuk 1, verse 13. He cannot be tempted by evil, James 1, verse 13. And in fact, God's absolute justice demands that he punishes sin with consequences that include adversity, calamities, disaster. And if I'm the recipient of it, to me, it's evil. Now, God's created moral beings with free choice, and free choice is the origin of moral evil in the world. So, let me just have a look at a verse in Genesis. We'll have a look at Genesis chapter 50 and verse 20. And so this might help sort of put some icing on this cake. But as for you, you thought evil against me, but God meant it under good, to bring it to pass, as it is this day, to save much people alive. So God permitted evil, but he didn't promote it. And it's God's plan to use angels to ultimately produce a greater good through it. And think of the greater good that Jesus achieved. And And sometimes I think, in addition to that, Kat, you can be in such despair, like some of these examples were, where Jesus reached out and healed them, that it was impossible for them to even digest that. Now, if I was the Assyrian general and I woke up one day and 185,000 of my soldiers were killed by one angel, I'd be pretty devo about that. But I don't know how many angels, the destroying angel, and that's what he's called in 1 Corinthians 10, took the lives of in the 10th plague, because it wasn't just the children. I mean, we sort of think that, you know, there's firstborn children, but if you were the firstborn son or you were a grandfather and you were the firstborn, then you, and sheep and oxen, everything. Every firstborn that angel took. So for the Egyptians that lost children, the angel was evil. So I think it helps to define evil as the consequences of sin. So in the garden, things are very good. That breaks down. And ever since then, we have disease, suffering, shame and death. But to be very clear, the 185,000 Syrian soldiers, 14,700 Israelites, all the firstborn of Egypt, all of the people that David is seeing that the angel is smiting is part of God's plan. God wanted that to happen. Amos chapter 3. Whoops-a-daisy. Shall the trumpet be blown in the city and the people not be afraid? Shall there be evil in the city and the Lord hath not done it? God can't sin. God is morally perfect, which means his absolute justice demands the punishment of sin. So let's just take a pause here for a moment. How does this then relate to us? Hebrews 12. No suffering seems to be joyous, but grievous. We can't say that trial is fun. Like, it's hard. It's difficult and painful. But if something bad is happening to us, then it's evil. Yet afterward, I'm developing you. I want you in the kingdom. I love you, says God. Afterward, it yieldeth the peaceable fruit of righteousness. So I think the popular belief was very close to the truth. Okay, there's an evil spirit. But the error was an assumption which I think we have somehow interpreted, that these people believed that there's an evil demon. It's not. What I've demonstrated is the term demon or unclean spirit was simply a synonym for an illness, an ailment of some description. There was powerful symbology that I think was used to help us stay in the straight and narrow path. But Jesus still had conversations with these demons. Now, some have tried to say, well, it's not, Jesus isn't talking to a third party. It's just, you know, maybe it's one of Legion's personalities that Jesus is talking to. Well, it's not just Legion that these conversations are going on with. So I think Jesus is talking to the angels. Okay, now, why did Jesus have to say, come out of him? And why, when this happens, is there such a violent reaction at times? So let's just think about us being either the poor kid that we read about in Mark 9 or his dad. So, come out of him. There is a process of cure and healing that Jesus is making public, and he's demonstrating that he's the one in control of it. If there is a physical reaction, like there was with the boy that we read about in Mark 9. Why did that happen? Was it a demonstration to the people watching, to the disciples, to the individual, or in that case, to the Father? Well, it's possible that it was all of them. So, in summary then of the alternative points, the spirits did exist, but they served a purpose: to get people to go to Jesus, to get people to believe in Jesus, but most critically, to get them to hear his message. The demons aren't fallen angels, but they are angels of evil. Notice the capitals and the smalls. If I was evilly afflicted, then to me, whatever condition I had, or whatever condition my child had, it was evil. These afflictions were administered by ministering spirits, who are angels. So I haven't got time to sort of deal with the case studies. I'm just going to deal with one thing briefly, though. Let's just whiz through the Transfiguration. We know that story quite well. I want to deal with the risk of trying to identify some of these conditions, okay? So let's have a look at the symptoms, some general information, and the causes of epilepsy. So one of the things that we notice in the demonic language is there's this tearing and this shrieking and crying. That is not consistent with someone who is having an epileptic seizure. So let's have a look at some of the symptoms. There's confusion, staring, rigid, stiff muscles, uncontrollable shaking. Occasionally, the loss of awareness and consciousness, and sometimes some other symptoms like anxiety, fear, or even deja vu, which I thought was interesting. Now, the reason why someone that's having an epileptic fit can't scream is that they're constricted. So I think that Jesus, who is just so brilliant to teach these lessons, he's giving the crowd and the dad in this case, I'm not so sure about the epileptic boy, because he's basically passed out, hasn't he? He's unconscious. They thought he was dead and Jesus had to revive him. But if we think about Legion and the pigs, all of Jesus' exorcisms end up in the pigs that go and drown themselves. And it says at the end of that story that Legion was then in his right mind. Just like bread and wine, that Jesus gives us physical symbols to remember his body and his blood, he gave Legion a physical symbol. So if he ever had a relapse of his condition, which is clearly mental, he clearly had some devastating and serious challenges. If he ever thought that might return, he could remember that, no, Jesus stopped it. And here's a weird thing about the demons. Demons can get into these people, apparently, but Jesus gets rid of them. Well, why can't they come back? They never come back. I guess they're not homing demons. Okay, so let's... I won't talk about the ghosts. We'll talk about just our summary. There's not enough books to tell us all of the stories about what Jesus did with his miracles. We're told there wouldn't be enough paper or ink to tell us all about it. And from time to time, we get snippets. And the pieces of these snippets and some of these things aren't always easy to put together, but I think it's worth trying. So for me, this topic has been a bit of a personal journey and I guess an indulgence in some respects. So, Catherine, you probably won't have to put up with it for a while. But we all have inner demons. Sometimes they're buried quite deeply, and at other times they bubble up and rise to the surface. So Jesus saw the desperate needs of the leper, the paralytic, the withered hand, the palsied, the widow's deceased son, multiple personality disorder, PTSD, the women with the issue of blood, Jairus' deceased daughter, two blind men, the mute, the possessed, the demon in Cana, the deaf man, the impediment, the blind man in Bethsaida, the epileptic boy, and the list goes on. But this story has to be about Jesus. With all of them, he looked at them in the same way and he said, I'm going to give you rest. I'm going to take your pain away. So he not only healed adult women, old men and children, but the parents of children who had nowhere else to go, no hope at all, and no one they could turn to. And Jesus' touch could take the ache away. He takes away the sting of sorrow, the sting of pain, the sting of helplessness, and ultimately the big demon, the sting of death. And that's the lesson. Fiery trials hurt, but they're for a purpose, because God wants us in his kingdom. That's why all things work together for good. Not to everyone, but to those who love and fear the Lord. So it should be comforting to us that our guardian angel's purpose is to bring us closer to Jesus, to prepare us for Jesus' kingdom. The disciples couldn't heal that epileptic boy. Their dad was hoping they could, but they couldn't. But you know, in the kingdom, that'll be our job. We'll be the ones who offer the kind word, the sensitive deed, and the relief of a healing touch to remove everyone's inner demons and maybe some outer ones too. Thanks, Anne.